This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
You'll learn that sometimes a virtual event can have something an in-person event doesn't. Take the annual Museum of History Cemetery Walk, for instance.
Everybody always wants to know the story behind the tree carvings out here, and so we're going to have a video that talks about each one of those tree carvings and how they came to be.
Candace Summers with the museum says they'll also have photos to supplement actor performances of people from the past. Plus, one of the state's most important Republican leaders reacts to President Trump's word choices on white supremacy in this week's debate. Hear from State Senator Bill Brady. Eric Stock reports on District 87 parents who worry about their young elementary school children getting sick if they go back to school. And hear about the world's biggest playable guitar on exhibit in central Illinois. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The Bloomington Election Commission will seek a judge's approval for its plan to fix a ballot problem that has halted early voting. Two judicial retention questions were accidentally left off ballots. About 9,500 vote by mail and early vote ballots were impacted. BEC Executive Director Tim Mitchell says they'll likely send new mini ballots to those people with just the two missing questions on it.
Any ballot that has been cast will be counted, and if they don't return it, essentially it would be like the equivalent of them just not voting in that race.
Mitchell says they'll likely go to court to seek a judge's approval given the unusual situation. McLean County has reached a new high with 13 COVID hospitalizations. The McLean County Health Department says two of those patients are in intensive care. County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says hospital bed capacity is good for now, but expects demand will increase.
Looking ahead at the flu season, we know it's going to be a difficult fall and winter for our community, for our state, for our nation.
McKnight says hospitalizations are a lagging indicator of COVID spread. Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons is announcing plans to retire near the end of the calendar year after 33 years in the department. Lyons took over as director in 2013. He recently came under fire from black athletes after he said during an online meeting that all Redbird lives matter. Following protests, Lyons said the athletic department would develop a plan to become more inclusive and sensitive to diversity issues. In a press release, university officials praised Lyons for his facility upgrades to Hancock Stadium and Redbird Arena, as well as his fiscal savvy. A spokesperson for Congressman Darren LaHood says he hasn't recently been in contact with President Trump or others who've tested positive for COVID-19 at the White House. LaHood did not attend Tuesday's debate in Cleveland. The congressman's spokesperson says he follows all safety protocols, including wearing a mask whenever he's in the Capitol or traveling to or from Washington, D.C. The director of the Peoria International Airport says he doesn't expect mass furloughs at United and American Airlines to impact service. Gene Olson says the flight schedules for October and November look largely the same as those from August and September.
Those flights require people to check people in, handle baggage, marshal the airplanes, all that kind of stuff. And so we've not heard about any kind of significant numbers of layoffs trickling down to the small airport level.
The two major airlines started to furlough 32,000 workers after federal lawmakers failed to agree on a COVID-19 relief package. The building manager of the UAW Senior Citizens Center in Pekin says they're working to eradicate the bacteria that causes Legionnaires' disease. The center recently had two cases of the disease and one person died. Building manager Don Bly says workers are just about done changing shower heads in the high rise.
We're replacing them with a filtered shower head, which means that it's got a special filter installed in it that will stop the bacteria from going out into the spray.
Blay says it's just a temporary solution as filters last only about a month. He says the plan is to have an entire new water softening system within 2 months. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. When District 87 announced plans to bring back in-school learning for its elementary students while in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, some parents said keeping the remote learning option isn't enough. They say the hybrid format doesn't sufficiently reduce the risk of infection, and it stunts the progress kids were finally starting to make with virtual learning. Eric Stock has more.
Megan Moore has a daughter in kindergarten at Washington Elementary. She also teaches at a private preschool where she saw how quickly COVID can spread. She says even though local coronavirus numbers are improving, it's still too soon to bring kids back into the classroom.
We are entering our most vulnerable children, little tiny guys who can't, you know, keep their mask on and sneeze out into public anyway. And we're throwing them into this atmosphere. It's not a good thing.
Parents can stay with the remote option for the rest of the year. Nearly 30% of students in grades K through 2 plan to take that option. Moore says that's what she'll do, but she's concerned her daughter may end up getting a different teacher. Tyson Moore has three children who attend Washington Elementary. He says to him the relationship between the student and teacher is fundamental to learning. He feels like his kindergartner is starting all over again.
He was starting to get teary-eyed and just said, so much is changing. I'm so tired of everything changing. And the idea that he's not going to be with his current teacher anymore, it's very hard for him.
Moore says the kids were just starting to get comfortable with remote learning and were finally ready to start learning. And parents were finally starting to get adjusted to the new schedule. And moving to a hybrid format of 2 days in school each week, 2 days independent learning, and 1 day online makes childcare an even bigger puzzle.
The families who have found ways to make the system work, which based on the community surveys, the majority of us, we find ourselves needing to rearrange things.
A District 87 survey showed most parents and students were adjusting well to remote learning, but the district says more young kids struggled. The two Washington Elementary parents recently took part in an online chat with several dozen parents, and they say many of them share the same concerns. They suggest the district should just keep everything online for the foreseeable future. Jamie Matthew is a Bloomington City Council member. His wife teaches at Washington Elementary. Matthew says he doesn't want to second-guess other public bodies who have tough choices to make, but he wishes the public knew more about how the district arrived at its decision.
I wish they were more forthcoming on the information they gathered to get to this decision.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says he understands parents have questions about transparency, but he says the district has what he calls an army of people who have a lot of experience and training.
I understand that parents can get frustrated when they don't have all of the information all at once, and that is one of the challenges we work with today, and some of that just relates to how quickly the news cycles are.
Some parents said they wanted to know who made these decisions and why teachers don't seem to be involved. Riley says teachers were involved in the school reopening discussions in the spring at the start of the pandemic, but he says more recently school administrators have largely guided the planning with input from health experts.
The only way we were going to be able to do this is to have a model that really hits all of the recommended safety measures put out by the Illinois Department of Public Health. And it's really hard to do that if you have too many voices trying to make that work. And I don't pretend to know that we have the right number.
Riley says no teachers or staff have quit since the school year started, but some have applied for family leave. Riley says the number of parents wanting to keep their kids online is about what he expected based on district surveys. He says the district will try to limit the number of students who end up with a new teacher.
But it is unavoidable that some are going to have to be with a different teacher. Now, these are all District 87 teachers. They're all high-quality people. They're very good at what they do, and they know how to build relationships.
Megan Moore says her daughter will manage yet another shift in plans, but she's concerned for those who go back to the classroom because they feel like they have no good option.
I'm sure that my daughter's not going to crumble if she goes to a different classroom. That's not going to scar her for life. But the real issue is the exposure and the educators and the staff and the other children getting sick.
And Moore says the virus hits close to home for her. She says her mother, who was living in New York, became severely ill in January with the COVID symptoms. There was no COVID testing available then. She suspects that her mother had the coronavirus. She says bringing kids back to school is just not worth the risk. I'm Eric Stock.
District 87 students return to the classroom October 26th. Grades 3 through 5 return in early November, but the district hasn't set a date for when parents must choose a learning option. Grades 6 through 12 will remain all online for now. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. At this week's debate, President Donald Trump declined to do what many elected officials find easy to do, disavow white supremacists. He later tried to clean up his remarks. They still hover over the election, though. Ryan Denham speaks with one of Illinois' top Republicans, Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington, about his reaction to the president's comments.
I thought he mishandled it completely. There's no question. We're the party of Abraham Lincoln. I'm a Republican because all lives are equal and should be treated equally. Even the life of the unborn. And the president completely missed an opportunity to share the fact that Republicans do not stand for white supremacy and that we believe in equality.
There are some high-profile Republicans who plan to vote for or have endorsed Joe Biden instead of President Trump this time around. Folks like Ray LaHood, John Kasich, Jeff Flake, Cindy McCain. Are you one of them?
Absolutely not. You may not always agree with President Trump's rhetoric. I don't. And you may not always agree with his tweets. I don't. But what I do agree with is the direction this country is heading and the opportunity that the Trump administration, through changes in government, have provided for everyday men, women, and children. I don't think any president maybe has made as much progress in growing the economy as President Trump did pre-COVID-19. I think he can do it again. I think Joe Biden will go back to the old Democratic playbook of tax, spend, regulate, that's not what this country was built on. And those aren't the policies that provide opportunities. Those people who formerly were Republicans who endorsed Joe Biden, I can't fathom their rationale, but I do understand the difficulty people have with the way Donald Trump handles some things. And we talked about it earlier. He completely mishandled white supremacy when the question was asked. And he makes those gaffes. We're all human, though. But by and large, if you judge by the policies and the economic development the Trump administration has brought to America, he's done a remarkable job.
Let's turn back to state matters, specifically the graduated income tax that voters are going to be weighing in on this fall. Recently, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton warned that all taxpayers could face a 20% increase in their state income tax if voters reject this proposed constitutional amendment. So what did you make of this shift in strategy on their part?
Well, first of all, I think that's indicative of the way in which this proposal is failing. People don't trust Democratic politicians when it comes to tax policy. And like we've argued, they understand that a fair flat tax requirement in our Constitution protects middle-income families' interest best of all. Not only the threat that the Lieutenant Governor made, but the biggest threat made too was that made by the Treasurer, who threatened that if the graduated income tax passes, they'll be able to tax retirement income. Well, retirees already pay enough taxes and property in other ways. And the last thing we need to do is start taxing retirement income and have them leave the state, like many people have done, because of the poor tax policy that the Democrats have ushered in. So I think it's indicative that people are waking up and realizing that this constitutional revision is a false promise and they need to defeat it. And then we need to go on and work towards sound budgetary policies and not threaten the public with a 20% increase.
So I guess what happens next? What happens if voters do reject the graduated income tax idea? Do you expect Democrats to indeed proceed with some sort of flat rate increase?
Well, nothing surprises me when it comes to Democrats in raising tax rates. They've already raised it to 5%. But I think there's a heavy price to pay if they go beyond that. So I think this is another false threat and one that I don't think serves our state well.
Congress has not been able to agree on another round of coronavirus relief. One sticking point has been whether and how much state governments should get. Do you think that states like Illinois should get more federal money, you know, beyond what we've already received?
I think the federal government needs to help offset the challenges faced by COVID-19. This is something that has shut down our economy in so many ways. And the states are a way in which to put resources into the hands of the people who need it to provide proper health care, personal protective equipment, and to keep people employed. Those resources can come directly to businesses or through the state. Governments have suffered as well, which is why we've argued that Governor Pritzker should be giving more money to local governments of the CARES Act money we've already received. So I think there's a balance here. I don't believe that Illinois should use the COVID-19 crisis as a excuse for a bailout of the past poor decisions that were made by Democratic governors. So I don't believe that's fair, but I do believe that stimulus and CARES funding to deal with this crisis and the effects the crisis has had on our economy and our people is warranted.
That's State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington speaking with Ryan Denham. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A gigantic world record playable guitar serves as the centerpiece of the Peoria Riverfront Museum's new exhibit on the musical instruments that rocked the world. H.P. Newquist is the founder and executive director of the National Guitar Museum in New York City and helped bring the exhibit to Illinois for the first time. Newquist tells Joe Deacon, Americans have had a fascination with the stringed instrument for centuries.
The guitar is the most popular instrument not only in America but in the world. And there's probably a number of reasons for that. One of which is you have to hold it so close to you. There's no other musical instrument that you have to hold close to you and embrace. And you can feel the music, you can feel the vibrations of the guitar against your body. Every other instrument you kind of reach out and sort of have to either hit something or play it by stretching your arms away from your body. So the guitar resonates with individuals at an intimate level, and I think that's translated all over the world to making it an instrument that's popularity is unrivaled.
What does it mean to be able to bring an exhibit like this to Illinois and to this museum?
Well, I think the Riverfront Museum is extremely unique in that it presents so many disciplines from art and history to science, that the things that we're presenting in the exhibit all tie in and dovetail with that very nicely. We talk about the design of the guitar, the history of the guitar, the science behind how guitars make sound. And so I think bringing it here to this museum is a perfect match.
Obviously, one of the headlining features of this exhibit is this giant guitar here. Can you tell me a little bit about this exhibit?
This guitar is a giant flying V, or a copy of it. It's 43 and a half feet long. It weighs just about 2,000 pounds, which is about the weight of a Mini Cooper. And it was built by an academy, a science academy in Texas about 15 years or so ago. And when they built it, the Guinness Book of Records certified it as the world's largest playable guitar. And when I say playable, it has an interesting sound. I wouldn't consider it music, but you can definitely create sounds with it.
What are some of the other interesting artifacts that you have here in this exhibit?
We have several historical artifacts. We have one of the very first six strings that was ever produced. It was made in Italy in 1806. Prior to that, guitars had anywhere from 6 to 14 strings. This was one of the very first six-string guitars. We also have one of the very first production electric guitars, which is called the frying pan. It was made in 1934, and it was created to play Hawaiian music. Most people think that electric guitars were created for rock and roll or blues or country. It's actually created to play Hawaiian music, so that's also a great piece. And then we have a few bits of eye candy. We have one of B.B. King's Lucille's. We have a guitar from Tony Iommi of Black Sabbath that he used on his final tour. There's lots of things that span the spectrum in between.
I understand there's also some pieces that are relevant to some of the musicians from Peoria and Central Illinois as well, right?
There's an entire section of the exhibit that focuses on recordings that were done in and around Peoria. So albums that were done by Styx or by REO Speedwagon or Dan Fogelberg are all featured in one section of the exhibit.
H.B. Newquist talking to Joe Deacon. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. The Evergreen Cemetery Walk lets you see dead people, only this year audiences will see them virtually. The McLean County Museum of History is going ahead with its popular annual walk, switching from live performances to video streaming. And as WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy discovered, moving the event online has unexpected benefits.
The 26th annual Evergreen Cemetery Walk takes place October 3rd through November 2nd. The walk brings voices from McLean County's history to life through live actor portrayals. Due to the pandemic, however, this year's walk is virtual. Candace Summers, Director of Education at the McLean County Museum of History, says there was no way that they were not going to do the walk in this extraordinary year.
When this whole craziness began, we knew there would be somehow, some way, we would continue this event because it's just too important to the community, to our school children, to our theater partners. I basically came up with like a 3-page list of the pros and cons of doing it in person as normal as we could and virtual. And I have to tell you, quite frankly, the cons to doing it in person greatly outweighed the pros. And, you know, it was a very tough decision. We had about 12 people in on a Zoom call to make this final call in May. And we got some flack. You know, people saying we called it too early, we're being too cautious. But in the end, we made the right decision and the best decision with what we had at the time. And I did not hear a single negative comment from our teachers, quite frankly. Many of them reached out to me and said, thank you for having this event, because no matter where our students are learning, they will still get to experience this event. Students make up 60% of who this event serves.
Because you're doing it virtually this year, you're able to do some additional content and have some additional videos. Can you tell me about that?
In addition to having the video of the performance where you will still meet every character we're going to have, we can add more information to tell you about other parts of the cemetery that we might not be able to include in the regular portion. For an example, the tree carvings. Everybody always wants to know the story behind the tree carvings out here. And so we're going to have a video that talks about each one of those tree carvings and how they came to be. We can include photographs of things associated with our characters this year, because we want people to have as good of an experience as we can online.
Do you see that you will be extending your reach through technology, going beyond what you would normally go through with an in-person event?
Absolutely. We have some schools from much further away that have signed up to participate in the walk this year. And I think the furthest homeschool group away that I found has signed up for this event is in Maryland. And a group we have specifically targeted for our virtual event are our older adults living in senior care facilities. People can experience the walk no matter what their abilities are, and they can be in the comfort and safety of wherever they may be.
Looking over your list of residents who are a part of Evergreen Cemetery that you're going to be featuring, I was surprised by one name, and that is Susan B. Anthony, who, to the best of my knowledge, isn't buried there.
No, she's definitely not buried here. So one of our researchers, Carol Straka, she came across that Edwin Hewitt, former president of Illinois State Normal University, debated Susan B. Anthony in downtown Bloomington at Schrader's Opera House in 1870. And the Pantograph and the Leader, the two newspapers at the time, have some great accounts of that debate. And we also have other information from lectures that Hewitt had given a couple years earlier about his views on why women should not vote. Plus, of course, Anthony's prolific documentation about her feelings on suffrage. And so we were able to create this script that is an interpretation of what that debate might have been like in Schrader's Opera House in downtown Bloomington. And so Hewitt is Anthony's anchor to this cemetery for our event. So that is how we are featuring Susan B. Anthony this year.
That's Candace Summers, Director of Education for the McLean County Museum of History in Bloomington. The Evergreen Cemetery Walk takes place October 3rd through November 2nd. For ticket information, go to the McLean County Museum of History website. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear more from Candace Summers about how to watch the Evergreen Cemetery Walk online, plus see videos of the performers at WGOT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We'd like to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.